My name is Ruth Hanussen. This is the second of my first week here. Today we begin a three-part series on the book of Hosea. I've divided it up into chapters 1 through 3. Tomorrow will be chapter 5 and 6, and the third day, chapter 11. I hope those are fairly even distinctions. I don't know. We may end up by Thursday with a 15-minute Bible study, but we'll try to... I'm trying to even them out. Since I'm very new at this style of leading, in other words, getting your act together weeks before you actually present your material, I didn't do a real good job of getting the books that I used to the bookstore. So I'm going to tell you what I used, and if you want to get them, they are not hard to get. The one thing that I did tell them, and this looks like sheer hubris, is that I told them to order copies of a four-part peer-led Bible study that I wrote for Campus Ministry Publications a year ago. They are in the bookstore, and they're cheap. I don't know, $2 something. 75 cents. Real bargain. Even if you need scratch paper. If they run out, right here on the back is where you can get them, and they'll send them out to you right away. Another book that I have found really good is called The 8th Century Prophets by Bernard Anderson. It's in the Proclamation series, Proclamation Commentaries. It deals with Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah, just about 100 pages. It's a real good overview. It's done by Fortress Press. Another one that I like a lot is by Abraham Heschel. It's called The Prophets. He has two volumes out on the prophets. This one deals with individual prophets, a chapter on Hosea, one on Isaiah, and so forth. And I really like it, as you can tell by it's falling apart. A third book that I'll just tell you about that I used, I don't imagine you'll want to buy it. It's an $18 hardback commentary by Hans Walter Wolff. And I use him a lot. That's why I cite my sources. I think the best way to do this is to just waltz you through Hosea 1 to 3. There's a lot of, as you know from the prophetic books, which are a good deal poetry, there's a lot of overlap, and there's double and triple meanings layered on, and some of what we discuss today will show up tomorrow, and you may want to talk about it a little more thoroughly or whatever. So I'm just going to trot this stuff out until my half hour is up, and then I'll let you discuss, and we'll see how that goes. Hosea, chapter 1, verse 1. I'm using RSV, because I'm assuming most of you have that. Okay. Oh, one other thing. If you're using something like the Jerusalem Bible, that reflects more clearly the Hebrew, and it'll be off by two verses. The numbering's different, so just remember that. Some of the other versions may be that way too. I'm not sure. Hosea 1:1. In the first verse, we get the best evidence we have for when Hosea wrote. He mentions five kings. The first four are kings of Judah: Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Hosea wrote in what was known as the Northern Kingdom. After Solomon died, his sons were feuding, and the kingdom was split into the north, which are the 10 tribes, which were often referred to as Ephraim. Hosea calls Ephraim Israel, the kingdom of Israel. And in the south were two tribes, and they were known as Judah, Judah being one of the tribes. For many of the prophets, well, for many of the biblical writers, it was a great tragedy that the kingdom was split in two. That was not God's will. It was a result of brother fighting against brother. And the more authentic of the two kingdoms was considered to be Judah. That was David's tribe. David was the king in the history of the people. And so Hosea, although he is in the north, in Ephraim, and writes to those people, he lists four kings of Judah. That as part of his dating. And there'll be time after time throughout Hosea that there will be mention made of Judah and of David the king and so forth. That reflects that pain yet over the separation. The only king of Israel he mentions is Jeroboam the second. This, as scholars will tell you, puts Hosea about the middle of the 8th century BC, or about 750, 745, something in there. And he writes in the two to three decades just prior to the destruction of the Northern Kingdom. I'll talk more about the political, historical situation tomorrow, but just briefly, the Assyrians were a terrible power on the rise at that time, And at 722, they razed Samaria, capital city of Ephraim, and the people were carried off. So Hosea is writing at the time when the sins of the people are getting really rank, and he is prophesying then the judgment that, God is going to bring upon them in the form of the Assyrians. Okay, starting with verse 2, we have the most information that we know about Hosea, and that is his marriage. We know very little else about him, what he did, how old he was. Don't know his father's name. Sometimes they have the name of the father of the prophet. Word of the Lord comes to him and says, go take a woman, a wife, of harlotry, and have children of harlotry, for the land commits great harlotry by forsaking the Lord. Well, if any of you heard yesterday's in the story of Tamar playing the harlot, you're going to think that's all I work with, which is not really true. There's a lot of theories on why in the world would God tell anyone, a prophet or whoever, to marry a harlot. I mean, that's just, God wouldn't do that. Of course not. So some say, well, this is just a parable, or it's just a symbol, or it's just a vision, or whatever. Heschel says it's no less reprehensible by being only a symbol than if God, in fact, required it. I mean, if God says it at all, it's nasty, whether you actually do it or you just, you know, it's just story. What Gomer was probably not a woman who was a practicing harlot. She was, let me break first and talk about fertility cults. When the people of Israel came out of Egypt and they received the covenant at Sinai, they were a desert people, a nomadic people. Their covenant was formed at Sinai, but right away, while Moses was still up there and they were still in the shadow of Sinai, they were getting a little bored, so they asked Aaron to make a god for them. Give us a picture of this god. You know, they weren't supposed to make any graven images. Make a picture of this god who brought us out, because we need to have a picture for ourselves. So he says, okay, bring me all your jewelry. And they melted down, and out pops this calf out of the little pot that they were stewing. And he was called Baal. And this was the god that brought you out of Egypt. So, I mean, they were right there at Sinai, at the covenant making, and were already a whoring after other gods. That's Hosea's language. He calls it a whoring. And so when they moved into Palestine, I used to think that they all moved in, one nice group, they killed everybody else off and just set themselves down. Well, that didn't happen. There was a lot of infiltration, and they began to borrow the habits of the neighboring peoples, which happens. If you know a little bit about what happens when Christianity comes to any new area, African Christianity looks a lot different than North Dakotan Christianity. And part of that is because of what was there before, or what came in before. No slurs on North Dakota, but I had a good chance to watch the Norwegians and the German Russians and how they worked out their salvation in fear and trembling. And it, depending on where it goes, you know, and the Irish Christianity, if any of you watch PBS, you see the Irish RM on Masterpiece Theater, how some of those biblical stories get retold by the kitchen help. Just, it's real delightful. But it shows you, you know, how things are shaped. And that happened to Israel. There was what was known as syncretism, and they began to blend. And the names they gave their children were partly made up with Yahweh and partly Baal, often back and forth. The goal of the fertility cults, well, let's see. First of all, there was some mother goddess, often referred to as Asherah, sometimes Ashtarte, different variations. She had a consort who was her brother, name of Baal. I grew up in Sunday school with Baal, but it's really Baal. And the two of them were responsible, thought the people, for the fertility of the land. Now, if you're just coming off a nomadic desert type of lifestyle, and you got to learn agriculture, you're going to go for all the help you can get. And here was this ready-made cult, fertility cult, which ensured, if you did follow the rules, ensured the fertility of the people, your descendants, so you had your immortality and your land was inherited, and food for you to eat, and your animals also for you to eat, and food for the animals. So the Israelites thought they couldn't lose. I mean, here you had Yahweh with the covenant and all this good stuff, and here was this other stuff to help you with the mundane day-to-day stuff. Really great. You know, that was nice stuff. So they began to practice that. Well, by the time of Hosea in the 8th century, they were really into it. And it was so ordinary that they didn't recognize it as idolatry. The assumption with Gomer here is that she was not a harlot, but that she had participated in an initiation rite in the temple area, or religious area, which would ensure her fertility. They aren't real sure what it is. Sometimes they think I think among the Amorites, they were to, young virgins were to spend 7 days in the temple area and to have intercourse with any stranger who happened to come along, and that was a part of the thing. But you did that. I mean, she was a modern girl. They all did that. You know, you go to bridal showers now, you went to fertility initiation right then. She didn't look all that evil. You know, she didn't look naughty. She was just like the rest. The judgment of harlotry is God/Hosea's judgment on this. And I think it's important for us to see her as pretty normal. Otherwise, we can say, wasn't she awful? We don't do that stuff. And we can miss the message of how we get hooked into a similar kind of problem that the fertility cults represented. What I think the fertility cults was after was survival. Now, there's nothing wrong with survival. We are creatures of a creator who, in Genesis, gives us the responsibility of caring for the creation. That includes us. That means you floss your teeth and you eat right and, you know, you do all that good stuff. That's a part of creating, being co-creators with God. But the God of the Hebrews, the God of the covenant at Sinai, insisted that he was the God of life even in the face of death. Even if you didn't survive, you had his marvelous, gracious gift of life. And whenever we get too much focused on just surviving, he wants to jerk us off that and say, you know, you can die. That's what the cross and resurrection, I think, is about. Resurrection means that Jesus' crucifixion was never erased. Good Friday's still there. It's not appropriate to have welcome teas on Good Friday. You really focus on the death because he really did die. And resurrection does not take that away, and resurrection does not mean that we will not suffer and die. It means that there is life that encompasses our survival and our failures and our death. And I think that's the issue with the fertility cults. And you can no doubt think of many instances in your own life and stuff where you get so focused on a particular area of your own survival, whether it's economic or your health or your reputation in the community, and you get such a stranglehold on that, you lose sight of all the life that God's giving you around. And the people had gotten to that point. They weren't trusting God alone anymore. They were trusting their own participation in those rites, which were an attempt to manipulate God. If I do this, God, you're going to give me the rain, right? And you're going to give me the flax and the oil and the grain and so forth. It wasn't waiting for God's gracious hand, was trying to buy it. Okay, so Gomer, this ordinary modern woman, he is called to marry her. And they have children, verse 4. And the first son is named Jezreel. For yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. What that all is about is Jezreel was the breadbasket of Palestine, and so its connection with the fertility cults was obvious. You know, it's like Chernobyl happening in the Ukraine. My goodness, you know, we're really hit at the heartland. But what had happened there was also a town where the royal family of Omri was, the dynasty. Jehu, a contender for the throne, had killed off most of the royal members. And so Jezreel, which was really a fertile plain, one of God's good gifts, had this horrible, tragic story surrounded with it. So this child is to bear this tragic name, reminding them of this slaughter that was so offensive to God, brother against brother again. And the house of Israel, because of that, would come to an end. Okay, she conceives again, bears a daughter, and this lovely child has the name of Not Pitied. No more will I have pity on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. but I will have pity on the house of Judah. Notice, still hearkening back to Judah, good Judah. And I will deliver them by the Lord their God. I will deliver them by bow. I will not deliver them by bow or sword or war or by horses or by horsemen. I often wonder, prophets gave their children symbolic names, but none of us would give our children names like Mili or Auschwitz or, you know. I mean, but that was what it was like, having a name like that. Can you imagine what that means? And then I wonder, when I think about names, we can maybe discuss this later. What does it mean to us when we are named Christian? What does that mean to us? You know? Third child, verse 8, when she had weaned, not pitied, she conceived, and the son's names, call his name not my people. Again, a symbol. For you are not my people, and I am not your God. Really casting them off. And now verse 10, 11, and verse 1 of chapter 2. Some commentators put it at the end of chapter 3, because we've got all of this judgment talk going on in the names of the children, and then we have a little bit of grace here. I don't know what the original order is, but one story that I heard at seminary was from Doc Kemmerer, who taught many, many, many of the Missouri Synod preachers for decades. And he was still there when I was at seminary. And I didn't have his class, but I heard the story that he said, you don't give the people 10 minutes of law, just really bury them deep under the pew, and then you give them grace and hope that they're going to hear it. He says you do a little law, little grace, little law, little grace, little law, little grace. And so, and each way you just kind of delve deeper. Somebody once told me that while law theologically comes before grace, psychologically we have to hear a word of grace before we can tolerate hearing law. And I think that's true. And so I think what Hosea has for us here, it's got a little law, little grace, little law, little grace. And so that's what's going on in 10 here, where he's looking far into the future, and he says, the number of people of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea. Remember Abraham? Which can neither be measured or numbered. And where it was said that you are not my people, you will be called sons of the living God. Remember Paul. And the people of Judah and the people of Israel shall be gathered together, not split anymore, but they will be returned. And they shall appoint for themselves one head, on the order of David, not two kings, and they shall go up from the land, and great shall be the day of Jezreel. Jezreel will then be redeemed. No longer will they remember the great slaughter, but they will remember the fertile plain where God gives his good gifts. And then the children's names, verse 1, say to your brother, my people, and to your sister, she has obtained pity. The children's names are redeemed too. Now, verses 2 until the end of chapter 2, 23, is on the order of a lawsuit. The husband is contending against the wife. And in the first verses, up through 15, he's talking to the jury. And then after that, 16 to 23, he addresses the defendant herself. First, he talks to the jury children. Plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband, that she put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts. They think, scholars do, that with this initiation rite was some kind of marking on the body. So it was obvious that you had been through this. They don't know what it was, but they, from this kind of language, they think that, you know, whether it was paint or something, that could be removed. And that's what's implied here, that she should, you know, cease and desist from that practice. Lest I strip her naked and make her as on the day she was born. Nakedness was really awful to the Old Testament peoples. We don't have nearly that same taboo against it as they did. And also, the nakedness can refer to, they don't have materials to make clothing, which again goes back to the fertility, the wool and so forth. Make her as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and set her in a parched land, and slay her with thirst. If you're trying to learn agricultural practices, you don't want to go back to wilderness times. That's too tough. Upon her children also I will have no pity, because they are children of harlotry. So steeped was Israel in this culture that the children too partook of the Spirit. I better ask now and ask you, stop now and ask you, who do you think the husband is who's making this complaint? God? It's one? Who's the other one? Hosea. This stuff is so overlapped, which is some of my dilemma in doing this in three sessions, because it's all here in one chapter and it's all, you know, in the other stuff. Abraham Heschel thinks that the reason God commanded Hosea to marry this woman is so that Hosea would know in his by his own experience the tragedy of marrying a woman who was who had participated in the rite and then leaves him. That's what's going on in two. She is left. So denounce her. That writing a bill of divorce, cast her off. She's left. It's between the lines. It's not real clear there. And yet later Hosea is commanded to take her back, which was against the law. It was against the law to do that. And so Hosea, in a sense, it's not so much to give the people an example, as that Hosea really understands God's pain. And so that when he writes this out of his own experience, but also the experience of Yahweh. And so we have this overlapping stuff. There's both Gomer here and the whole people of Israel in their harlotry, as Hosea terms it. Okay, verse 5, "For their mother has played the harlot. She that conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers. Who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink?" They forgot that those were God's good gifts. It was the lovers, the whole cult. Baal gave those gifts. And so she says, I got to go tend to them because I need to get my hire, my pay. Number 6, God says, "Therefore I will hedge her up her way with thorns." He's going to prevent her from continuing this. "And I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her path." I think that's talking about 722 when they'd be taken off the land and would not have the opportunity anymore. 7, "She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. She shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then she will say, being desperate, I will go and return to my first husband, Hosea, Yahweh, for it was better with me then than now. 8, "And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished upon her silver and gold, which they used for Baal, the golden calf. Therefore, verse 9, I will take back my grain in its time and my wine in its season, just when it's ready to be harvested, the grain and the wine, I'm going to take them off. And I will take away my wool and my flax, which were to cover her nakedness." That may refer again to chapter 3. Or verse 3, "strip her and make her naked." Also, you might remember, this week we're talking about inclusive language in some of the sessions. God, in chapter 3 of Genesis, makes Adam and Eve clothes. He's a seamstress. And here's a little glimmer of that, too, that he provides the materials with which to clothe the people. Verse 10, "I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one shall rescue her out of my hand." 11, "And I will put an end to all of her mirth, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her appointed feasts." These were the times when they did their celebrations. Like we might say, I'll put an end to Christmas and to Easter and to Pentecost and to LCW Sunday or whatever it is. I don't know. Those were the when they did their things. You notice that Sabbaths are in here too. That was taken over by the cult. Sabbath, which was... shows up as early as Genesis 1. Verse 12, "And I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, these are my hire, which my lovers have given me. I will make them, God says, I will make them a forest, and the no longer cultivated land, but forest, and the beasts of the field shall devour them. And I will punish her for the feast days of the Baals, when she burned incense to them," that was a part of the cult, "and decked herself with ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, says the Lord." Now in 14, we start a re-romancing section. Still talking to the jury here for two verses. "Therefore, behold, I will allure her," this is Yahweh talking, "and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her." Why to the wilderness? Kind of hot and dusty out there. the wilderness was the place of the covenant. And as Hosea talks, and his primary picture for God here is one of a marriage covenant, that God takes them back to the original place. You know, like you go back to the restaurant where you had your first date, or you go back on your 25th, you go back to where the honeymoon was. You go back to where it all began. And so he takes her into the wilderness. Another thing about wilderness, oh, there's lots of biblical stuff about wilderness, but if you've ever lived in the desert and spent some time there, away from the city, and see that Las Vegas really does have smog or whatever, and you're quiet, and you let it grow on you, many people have said that they have found God there. Perhaps it's because there's nothing else there. It's very, very alone. And, you know, Jesus' temptation was in the wilderness. It's a place, for the biblical writers, the wilderness is where you meet God. And you have your mission renewed, going back to Sinai. So he takes her into the wilderness. That's also true in Revelation, by the way. When the woman with child is trying to get away from, oh boy, is it the dragon or serpent, whatever is going on at that point. And she's whisked away to the wilderness. That's safety. That's the place of God. That, there it's safe. The city isn't in Revelation. And 15, and there I will give her her vineyards. Give her vineyards in the desert? Sure. And make the valley of Achor a door of hope. Do you remember the story of Achan? When the Israelites were coming into Palestine, they plundered or they demolished the city of Ai, and they were all told not to take plunder. Achan took some. So many talents of silver, whatever, hid them under his tent. The judgment was that the entire family was, I think they were burned or stoned or something. Anyway,
swallowed
they were.
By the earth.
No, they weren't swallowed by the earth. That was the sons of Dothan or something, I think. I don't remember. Anyway, they were killed. And I always thought that was so mean to do that to his family. But the way you really hurt a man then was to cut off his name entirely, which means to kill his entire descendants. And there was a kind of a clan at that point, 20 people or so, I think. They were buried in the Valley of Achor. Again, it's, you know, it's Flossenbürg, Auschwitz, any of the concentration camps that yet today have a very tragic name for us. And he is going to make the Valley of Achor, the site of this tragedy, a door of hope. God is going to turn it all around. He's going to redeem it. And there, still 15, there she shall answer as in the days of her youth and at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. Now this is just slightly fanciful, because if you all remember, they weren't even across the Red Sea, I don't think, and they were all complaining about going back to the flesh pots of Egypt. Like our five-year-old son on the way to Holden Village. We weren't out of Nevada, and I want to go to Carson City. You know, you always want to go back. So this is just slightly fanciful, because they were just horrible in the wilderness already. You know, they weren't all that lovely then. Anyhow, this is where the courtship will happen again. Verse 16, and now we are still in the romance section. But Yahweh, this is pretty clearly Yahweh, not Hosea, is talking directly to the defendant, to Israel, to the wife who left. And in that day, says the Lord, in that day is sometimes often a code word for the good future, you know. Well, sometimes, well, yeah, well, here it is anyway. And in that day, says the Lord, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal. That's real funny, because in Hebrew, the word for husband is Baal. So in Hebrew, it'll be, you will call me my Baal, and no longer will you call me my Baal. Baal was not only the name of the consort god, but also husband, lord, master. So we have a pun in the Hebrew, which you don't see here. For 17, for I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be mentioned by name no more. Remember I think it's the Elijah story, at Carmel with the prophets of Baal. If you've ever heard Mendelssohn's version of that, Baal hear us, on this big chorus that goes on. Here the names of the Baals will be removed, and they won't call on them anymore. 18, I will make for you a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the creeping things of the ground. all of creation is going to be brought into this covenant with the people. Here they were striving so mightily to produce a little bit to for their life. And on that day, God's going to have a covenant with all of the creation for them. Everything will be brought in into the picture. And he's going to abolish war. Abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land. And I will make you lie down in safety. And I will betroth you to me forever, and I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in steadfast love and in mercy. And I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. Someone after the staff Bible study came up and told me that this is one of the four passages that observant Jews have in their phylacteries. You know what phylacteries are? They're little boxes, and they have Bible passages in them. One's on their forehead and a couple on their arms, I think, the frontlets and the arm things. Sometimes you'll see them in pictures, paintings or whatever. It's not done in this country. At least I've never seen it. But this was one of the four passages. This was a crucial, you know, it's like your favorite Bible passage, John 3:16 or something. This is a favorite of theirs, and one that every day they renewed their marriage covenant. When they said their prayers, they thought of this passage and the betrothing to Yahweh, kind of like our baptismal covenant. Luther talks about daily drowning and rising to new life, and every day you should remember your baptism, he says. 21, and in that day, says the Lord, I will answer the heavens, and they shall answer the earth, and the earth shall answer the grain, the wine, and the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel, the fertile plain, and I will sow him for myself in the land. Again, all of creation is going to get in the act. If the earth cries up and says, we need water, the heavens will answer. And if the plants that are growing, the grain, the wine, and the oil, cry to the earth and say, we need nourishment, the earth is going to answer. All of creation is going to be working in sync, and it's going to be a good gift of God. And 23, and I will have pity on not pitied, and I will say to not my people, you are my people. And he shall say, you are my God. Again, the names are redeemed. 3, quickly. And the Lord said to me, go again. This is Hosea. God says to Hosea, go again, love a woman who is beloved of a paramour and is an adulteress. This looks pretty clearly that Hosea has left him for another man. She's living with someone else. Even as the Lord loves the people of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins. Cakes of raisins were in some way used in the cult rites. They aren't sure what, but it was a sensual kind of thing. And it kind of points to the fact that people left Yahweh just for sensual pleasure. You know, that was part of it. It was just nice. Great stuff. Padded pew seats and piped in music. Oh, that's awful, isn't it? So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a lekath of barley. All that totals 15 shekels, which was the bride price. You'd give that to the father to buy a bride. However, it was against the law. Not only didn't you have to do it, it was against the law to remarry a woman who had committed adultery. So God is asking Hosea to go against the law. And in a sense, God is breaking his own law by calling Israel back to him. He goes against his own law. He does with us too. And I said to her, verse 3, you must dwell, and here we've got Hosea and Yahweh overlapping. You must dwell as mine for many days, and you shall not play the harlot or belong to another man. So will I also be to you. Yahweh, Hosea are pledging their faithfulness in a culture where it was all right for a man to have several wives and concubines. But here the husband is pledging himself to fidelity. Verse 4, for the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or teraphim. No king or prince meant they were going to be waltzed off into captivity. This is predictive of 722. Without sacrifice or pillar, ephod, or teraphim. These were all the stuff of their religion. The sacrifice, they did have sacrifices. The pillar, they would have big stone pillars where people would gather around. Ephod and teraphim are, they use them to determine the will of God. And scholars aren't real sure how they did that. It wasn't exactly lots, but somehow a couple stones they manipulated somehow. It'd be like we couldn't have our our altars and our candles and our clerical collars and our chalices or something, you know, all of the stuff, the symbol stuff that is important to us in our religion would be taken away from them. Verse 5, afterward the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. Again, Judah pops up. And they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. I went past my time for presentation. Shoot.
Yeah. It's very clear that this text was written by a man, and I was trying to see the point of view of the woman in this text. And I was trying to see that if a woman dares to abandon a man and leave the man, what does the man do? He calls her a prostitute. Isn't it there?
And in this story or in 20th century?
Well, anyway, because in the Old Testament, women were not allowed to ask for divorce. Only men could do that. And if a woman dares to do it, you know, I think there is something different there. And a question for you, until what point is there a struggle with a male god, Yahweh, and a female goddess, which, you know, whose name doesn't even appear here, because a man doesn't think that a woman or a female can be a goddess, because the text always refers to Baal.
Yes.
So until what point is there a struggle between the feminine goddess responsible for the cult of fertility and the male god responsible for the power and the war and so on?
Yeah.
Is there a struggle?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's real tough. And a lot of women who are really into feminist things, well, I guess I am too in some ways, will not deal with this or with the scriptures, period. You know, and some women won't deal with the church fathers. They're sexist. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, so is Martin Luther. And so am I sometimes. It's not flattering to women. It is not. The very idea that the male here is the wounded divine person, you know, and women are relegated to junk.
They're bought like property.
Yeah, yeah. It's real hard for us 20th century folks to jump in there and say they were doing all this wrong by our sensibilities. I think we really need to, the best way to do it, it's still my favorite prophet, I don't know why, partly because 11, I think, Come Back Thursday has a whole different thing too. The best thing I can do is to pop into the story as best I can and say, okay, that's the world they live in, and now let me rattle around in there and find the good stuff, rather than just throw the whole thing out and say it's all junk and I ain't gonna look for anything in there because it's not worth my time. And I think that's to sell it far too short. I think that the thing that can kind of crack us open here, if we can sidestep how women were treated, is that God is the very God who always says, I am not human, and who had an aversion to anything sexual, is here as a marriage partner and seducing a woman. That's the real eye-opener here, that we have a picture of a God who is in a marriage covenant. That, I think we can learn a lot from that. And, you know, when we talk about, well, is God father or mother and the pronouns and stuff. I mean, this is, it's obviously masculine. That's clear. But that's really different. We don't think of God as a husband. And in a sense, it was real bold of Hosea and God, whoever, you know, however it parsed itself out. I don't always claim to know that. I never claimed to know it. That, you know, when they're fighting the fertility cults, which was an issue of sexuality, that they take that image and go with it. You know, you don't, what could be a contemporary situation? I don't know, it looks like they're just doing more of the same. You know, so that's rather bold to even do that, I think.
Do you know if there are any rabbinical teachings that would show, that would say anything about how this would be addressed to primarily a male audience? I mean, one of the things that intrigues me about that story is that they take that, what is to us a very negative image of woman, and And what they would have to do would be to apply that to the male religious leaders of their time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there are, I don't know anything about this as far as contextual application, but that must have been fairly offensive, and I would have enjoyed that offense.
Yeah, I think it was. They're probably... the men do not get off easy here. Even perhaps Baal is mainly mentioned because he's the contender to Yahweh. He's the metaphor she goes running for, for the lovers. And so the mother goddess is not mentioned. Although if you look at secular materials of the time, the mother goddess was primary, and the consort took kind of second seat. So. I really struggle with this because there's a lot that feminist types are doing with the mother goddess in this day and age, and trying to reclaim some of, why is it that the goddess keeps popping up throughout history? And there are some historical studies that it was around before Yahweh. It keeps popping up in Israel, even though there are strong taboos against it. Even the witches were still had some links with that. The mother goddess had stuff with herbal healing and stuff, And so some of us wonder, what was so bad about it? And I don't know. I struggle with it. And I keep reading and I toy with it. And I guess I still come down on the side of that. Well, I guess that the issue of survival in life, that somehow it's looking for a shortcut. And as a Christian, I guess I always run it up against the crucifixion and resurrection. How does it play against that? Is there room for failure? If there's no room for failure in this religion, it's not Christian. Or this aspect or this thing, If you don't understand failure, if your religion is always based on being successful, whether it's infertility or... a lot of the TV preachers strike me that way. I don't watch many of them, but they strike me as, you do this, this, and this, and this, and you'll get ahead in the world. How different is that from the fertility cult? Sure, you got your faith. I heard one guy once, only for 20 minutes, and somebody asked me to watch him. He wanted some feedback. He never called then, but it gave me a good sermon idea. He might have been Falwell, but I wouldn't swear to it. He said, a Christian is someone who trusts God and reads their Bible and prays every day and goes to church and is da-da-da-da-da-da-da and patriotic and on and on and on and on and on and on. And that's all nice. But being a Christian is trusting God, period. And all the rest of that stuff may be very nice, but it is not Christian. And I think we have to be real careful about using the word Christian as an adjective. Christian prayer, Christian Bible study, Christian churches, Christian da 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 da. A Christian is a person, period, who trusts God, and usually intermittently. We all get caught up in the survival game, how will, I used in the staff Bible study, I do a lot of recycling, and sometimes I get so intent on recycling, crushing beer cans and taking papers to the newspaper joint and stuff, that I get real cranky with my kids because I got a real schedule of unloading myself of all of this stuff, And there have been times when the gospel has broken through and I have decided that it was a brave act of faith prompted by God that I not recycle that day. And that I trust God with his own creation, that he is going to work that out. And that is butted right up against the fact that in Genesis we are given the creation to care for that. Care for it. And that includes all of the stuff and all of the people. Caring for those who don't have enough. And so next day I go back to recycling, and when I get too uptight with that and think that my survival, my opinion of my liberal peers on whether I, I'm using cloth diapers and recycling this and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You see, that's a survival issue too. What my peers think, whether I'm doing the right thing or not. And now that I'm in Carson City, Nevada, and nobody does much of that, I could go and be survival-oriented, and they all tell me to buy a clothes dryer. Well, I can be haughty and say, well, I'm doing the right thing, they'd laugh. But we all get caught up in those survival things. And whenever I think I got that the gospel experience, whenever I can laugh about it or get kind of an aha experience, that's a real clear indication to me from hindsight that I've had a stranglehold on my own survival in one way or another, you know. And that breaks through, and then you decide, well, it's God's. And I think that's what they did, and I think that's what we do, which is why we need to be real careful about not saying, look at those idolaters. We don't do that sort of stuff. We are so superior. And then I think that's also good reason to see Gomer as just an ordinary woman who just done what all the women were doing in her time. Otherwise, we miss the point, and we see them as really naughty. And we don't do that stuff. And we do. We do that stuff. And yet God calls back again and again. I will allure her. It's really seductive language.
Well, it seems really interesting because Yahweh says that, well, as God, He will provide the food, everything. And it reminds me of Genesis. But, you know, the way God provides it, it's not that the goddess of fertility did it, because the goddess of fertility was the earth by itself. So it's very easy to see things popping up with the earth, things coming, the green and the trees and so on. But in Genesis, God orders things. God as part of that, come life, and then life comes. And so I think there must be a little bit of confusion by these people too, because they can see that the God of fertility does these things, but our God only orders them. So,
Yeah, yeah. I guess, you know, we need to, we best appreciate it if we see their confusion and ours too. That it didn't look all that bad. I mean, it's like, I don't know. What do Lutherans do? I don't want to pick on the Catholics with their St. Christopher medals. But, I don't know what Lutherans do. You have Bibles on your coffee tables, or you don't read them, but they're there, you know, can't hurt. I don't know. I can't think of anything. There was a book, though. A guy did a...
Infant baptisms that are done just people who have been out of the church for a while.
Yes.
Let's bet that parents can be extremely frightened over that period of time between where grandparents get to work. It's been 3 weeks now. Are you going to baptize this child or not?
Yeah.
It can't hurt.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. 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 And you know, that's real. Talk about confusion. That's difficult for us too, because one of the things we say is that God creates faith. But yet Lutherans do not stand on street corners with water hoses and baptize anybody who comes down the road because it can't hurt. You know, we don't do that. Now, why don't we do that? The reason I think we don't. What was that?
I said it might if they hit you.
It might if they hit you, she said, hurt. Luther had went two ways with communal and individual sacraments. The Roman Catholics at his time went all towards communal with their sacraments. That the community, that's why you baptize infants and give communion to young children, because you trusted the community to you know, support and to bring it up. The Anabaptists went to, you don't baptize or give communion until they understand what's going on in their own head, a more of an individual thing. Luther went both ways. He went with the communal with baptism, infant, and he went with an older, more like age of accountability with communion. And so an important thing that we always need to remember with baptism, and that it is communal. I hate having to do Saturday afternoon baptisms because it's convenient for the godparents coming in from wherever off. Where is the community in that, you know? And when that's just all aside, and then the baptism is just kind of a magic thing because it won't hurt, and we don't take seriously the responsibility of bringing up this child, even though God does this thing, and we say that. And they are really, Lutherans have a lot of paradoxes and a lot of tension, and when we really feel those, I think we're probably on target. With the faith. I'm talking too much. This is your half hour.
I just had an idea that the female fertility guy is going to be male fertility.
It is hard. Yeah, yeah. The whole thing of whether God's masculine or feminine is, you know, God probably isn't either and yet is both. But we talk about how really, well, all we have is human language to talk about God. And even the revelation, we talk, use our human language, English or Hebrew or whatever. And that has limits. And so when we talk about a God, and the biblical writers are bold in talking about God in human terms. And so that's either male or female. I mean, that's all we understand. And that's all we have. Understand is beside the point. That's all we have. And they were in a patriarchal culture. And you do talk about God out of your own experience. You just do.
There's one thing. This whole story is based in an agrarian society. They are trying to grow crops.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us do not exist in that type of society anymore. So it would be sort of interesting to explore what is it we put our trust in.
Mm-hmm.
What are we depending upon in the same way? What are we running after in the same way as Gomer was doing with Baal?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the government to solve all of our problems? Is it our own success, our own education perhaps?
Mm-hmm.
What are those gods that we struggle with in the same way and do not trust God for?
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of them out there.
Yeah, and I think for, you know, each of you, you can come up with your own list. And I mean a list. Everybody's got several. Yeah. I just kind of bring that up, you know. What do you think about it? I mean, do you have any? I don't have a whole lot on that. I just, sometimes it's a safe word for us,
so
you know.
We've gotten to the point now where Christians are so secularized that a lot of people may become Christians or who see the name Christian don't even think about it, or they don't realize what Jesus there is in the people.
Yeah. I was thinking at our baptisms. Go ahead, though.
But not only just, you know, naming a Christian, but naming them after a person. I want this boy to be like his father. I want this child to be like his grandmother, and she will grow that way because your grandmother will be a good, upstanding young person in the community, and this is all we'll be doing. And their child is dumped on you, and they have to view their life as being this other person, just like these children are. You know, the failure of all the people of mankind. Well,
the
whole family,
yeah,
like
yeah. Did I see another hand or was it a foot? I think, you know, with the advent of Christian Yellow Pages and stuff, when I was thinking of Christian, I was thinking when you are named Christian at your baptism. Some people say, I'm a Christian, and I'm supposed to immediately have a relationship with them. You know, it's kind of, like a member of the lodge or yeah, it's the password, you know, and I think that.
Christian candidates. Christian
yeah, politics, yes, yeah.
Same problem.
Yeah, yeah. And it used to be a word that you didn't noise around or you might be killed, you know, in the early centuries of the Christian church. Obnoxious, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Ingrid.
I have a problem with our attitude about prostitution because I know some of that. and we're clearly gifted people in our work in our practice because they have no other income, no children support. I mean, I know that the prostitution is a really bad thing that time, the prostitution will bring out false documents. Yesterday in physical, we were using prostitution as the absolute measure of the worst thing that could be. Physical. I wonder if the Gomer was, I wonder if he could learn from the prostitution.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of, he's dealt with prostitutes.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't think there was a bad.
Yeah.
I wonder if there is a true line.
If there's a true what?
A true line on prostitution. There's nothing you could really safe and true.
Yeah.
Because there's so bad.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, you know, from this, harlotry is Yahweh's Hosea's judgment on the people's behavior. Well, she might have been, you know, gone through the initiation, right, and left her husband and gone to another man and maybe really wasn't a harlot as we understand it, or a prostitute. I guess a real interesting thing to talk about is I think it's in Luke, where the woman of the street comes in and anoints Jesus' feet with oil or with the perfume, and he says, your sins are forgiven. Did she continue in her profession? What do you think? That's right. Well, if she in fact was a prostitute,
yeah,
that's...
Are we big enough to say there were prostitutes in the Bible that continued as prostitutes?
Lutheran theology has always maintained that no one profession was above another. No one worked. That they were all were worthy.
Well, don't we usually feel that the word go and sin no more means that she disbelieved?
Yeah, but I don't think in that particular story go and sin no more are there. I don't believe.
No,
I mean, isn't that told to all of us? And we all keep doing it. You know, so are we to say that that particular kind of sin is worse than the kind of stuff we do?
But that's a different question, or a different kind of answer to the thing that says Jesus didn't think that that was bad or that they were good. I mean, I think that we need to take that the other way around. Our problem is too often that we think that what we're doing is good and what they're doing is bad. And we have to recognize that often what we do is, you know, see, I used to use the word often, because I don't want to say that what I do is as bad as my life.
I think it's another example, too, of where sin is bad for us. It's not because what is done is reprehensible, but because it's bad for us. Being a prostitute doesn't make someone necessarily an evil person, but it certainly is not good for the person.
Yeah, I think that if they went and they said going to or do some reprehensible, if they go and they try and do the will of God more, that if they feel, if they feel more better about themselves and do more things for themselves instead of being human, they felt bad about being prostitute, but then they would quit. They felt like smoking cigarettes was bad, the temple of their bodies, and they quit from their soul.
Yeah, I guess the question with that is, if that was all she had, if that was all she had to make a living, that was her only option, if she continued in that way to make a living, did God cast her off?
Or if God would probably, if it didn't work out,
there's the dole, I guess. Yeah.
Could it be that sometimes I believe this, that the Bible is written that when you use the term prostitute, to me it means the truth. And when you say priest,